Support of WAER's Syracuse Speaks program is made possible thanks to the St. Mary Ann Cope Shrine and Museum's Empathy in Action Initiative, making relevant the values of Mary Ann and her sisters to today's issues and challenges. Empathy in Action is working with our local companies and service organizations to help incorporate compassion and unity into our day-to-day lives and shape a kinder community. Welcome to Syracuse Speaks from 88.3 WAER. I'm Katie Zolkowski. As Black History Month comes to a close, Syracuse Speaks is sharing some parts of Central New York's Black history, looking at influence on music, activism, and community. African Americans have a rich and often undertold legacy in the area. Later in the program, WAER's Chris Bolt explores the connections and history between Syracuse's Black community and the city's music scene. We'll also have a discussion on organizations making a difference in the fight for racial justice. But first, we take a broad look at history with Syracuse University African American Studies professor, Dr. Joan Bryant. Dr. Bryant is the custodian of the Black History Preservation Project, a virtual Black History Museum that includes photos, documents, and interviews from the region.
There were members of the community, Syracuse Black community, who worked on projects. So we trained them to do oral history interviews, and we interviewed them as well, and had scanning days where people brought their photographs. And the point was to document people's experiences of life in Syracuse, particularly related to the 15th Ward and destroyed, and a lot of people focus on that. So this was, you know, to ensure that people's voices and the images they had of life in Syracuse were part of that story.
I lived in Frisbee Court, and when they built Upstate, I lived in Frisbee Court, and we ate dust for breakfast, dinner, and supper. This how dusty, and you know, from the construction of it. Mm-hmm. And even the road, Monroe Street, was so torn up that people would put boards over the holes to drive to be able to get into Frisbee Court. And you know, it stayed like that. You know, that's when we really should have band together and protested. And see, I had just began to become involved in community action kinds of things shortly after I moved out of Frisbee Court. And that's one of the reasons that I really spoke out against that steam plant being built in the area, because I know what I went through when they built Upstate. You know, if it's no problem, then build it out in suburbia. You got plenty of land. Build it out of your
I think it's hard to look at the documentation and say, oh, yes, this was the experience of community. This documents the experience of community. You only get that through oral histories. And even from the photographs people took, because they took pictures of people and streets. And so the idea of slums doesn't capture their experiences of relationships.
My grandmother and my mother, but my grandmother mostly, she would go to the neighbors. And if they were sick, she would make soup and take it to them. And it didn't matter about the colors. And what I started to say was it was predominantly Jewish and Black, and then there were a lot of Native Americans, and then there were Greeks, Polish, and my very best friend Annie Petrusik was Ukrainian and Austrian. And we stayed best friends till we were about 13 or so. But it was when the divide came, when I knew I couldn't do things or go places that she could.
Oral histories are a way of collecting people's memories and stories. And in this case, you know, their story is about a place that no longer exists. And the records around that, the destruction of the ward, are from sort of the official side of the story, the official stories. You know, some newspaper accounts, you know, depicting it as a slum to justify urban renewal or urban renewal records, but there are no sort of records of what people experienced before and during that and after those changes. So I thought that was, you know, we thought that was important to have, to hear a fuller story and to fill in gaps.
Housing good housing wasn't offered to minorities at the time because there were also landlords in the city of Syracuse that were prejudiced. People followed one another. When urban renewal happened, minorities, I live on South Ave now. When I was a child, blacks didn't live on this side of town. When I was a child, Roosevelt High School, which is over on Brighton, were no blacks on that side of town either. So what happened is blacks now are all over. I mean, they're north, south, east, and west. So when a community is destroyed and people don't have that camaraderie that they had as young kids growing up together, they don't have any attachment. So therefore, you don't have any bonding, which is very, very important. If you don't have bonding, I mean, you go your way and your next door neighbor goes his way, and sometimes you may speak and you may not speak. But when we were kids, I mean, everybody spoke to each other and everybody knew each other. But that's the signs of the time, and that's what's happened.
Syracuse was a great migration destination. So it was interesting to think about the parameters of community, that there were close connections among people in the 15th Ward, but also connections, ongoing connections to relatives and family members in the South, or even just places in the South. So that was a critical part of the story, to think about the boundaries of community beyond this particular space.
I came to Syracuse, New York on a vacation to visit my aunt in 1959, and it has been extended vacation because I'm still here. And since then, a transplant Syracusan, I have enjoyed every second of it. I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, but I resided in Bessemer, which is 16 miles south of Birmingham. Went to school there, went to Miles College.
So I think that there are these projects are widespread. People are doing local documentaries across the country. And it's it's sort of an awareness that archives just don't tell all the stories. I mean, even if you think about the images, which are really critical. And so I think there's a growing awareness of the importance of local stories, not a growing awareness, a new wave of awareness and appreciation for local stories and the importance of collecting them.
I was born and raised here. I stayed here until I left to go to college, but the winters have always been very difficult for me.
Why?
Just too much cold and snow, which my mom says, I don't know what you complained about. You went outside and played every day, mm-hmm. Which, you know, I did. I can remember the snowball fights, going sledding. I can remember we got snowed in, couldn't get out.
One of the challenges of this kind of project is sustainability. I mean, even talking to people who've been involved in the project in the community, I mean, they reference the recurring focus on Black Syracuse, but people ask the same questions and talk to the same people and tell the same stories. You know, it's a question about sustained and broadened, deeper relationships and partnerships that are a problem when random faculty, like me, you are people who are carrying out the projects and who don't have time or resources to develop a full-fledged project. So that's a real challenge.
My first 10 years of life, I spent what we called the block, but it is now better known as Armory Square. Okay. There's a building there, and I'll show you some pictures. Okay. But, lemongrass, restaurant, that building was a black little island. We lived there, the Harlows, you probably know the name of Harlow, Carmen, who ran for mayor, but his grandmother, and the Tuckers, the Nellens, there was a whole community. We had a whole community, that whole building. Okay. We were colored Negro, black African Americans.
Right. I'm glad that there is something, and I hope it inspires other people to pick up the mantle to do collaborations, especially now that people whose stories you'll find on that site are aging and dying. So there are more stories beyond the 15th Ward and the Great Migration. I mean, there are their children. There is the South Side. And those stories are not being documented as far as I know.
Back when I was young, the majority of men would work on construction jobs and all kinds of, you know, jobs, and maybe dirty jobs. But they'd come home and they'd wash up, they'd really clean up, and then they'd put on their suits and shirts and ties and a hat. They always had a hat. And they would go out and have a drink or something. But they always did that. They always were dressed. And I thought that was special.
Black life in Syracuse is not just the past, even though I'm interested in the past. So I think it is important to get people's current experiences of life in Syracuse as part of the virtual archive.
Experience. Every day you walk out the door, you know, wherever you live, you know, cherish it, remember it, document it, take pictures of things, take pictures of family reunions and events, and so you can go back and look at that or document it, write it down, so you can go back and say this happened on this day, you know, President Obama, first Black African American president, so you'll know that, because they're not always going to teach you that in school, like the 15th Ward. We cannot forget places like the 15th Ward in Syracuse, New York, okay, because we all got stories. We all got history, we all got documents, we all got pictures, we all got some good things that we can share.
Thank you to the Black History Preservation Project for allowing us to use their interviews in this piece. You heard from Carmen Harlow, Clarence Dunham, Donald Caldwell, Emma McDonald, Gladys McElroy, Majorie Williams, and Valerie Flanagan. Full interviews with them and many other community members can be explored at ourstories.syr.edu. More from Syracuse Speaks is coming up on WAER, so stay with us.
Hey, I'm Elsa Chang from All Things Considered. Delivering trusted news and information to our listeners is what the public mission of WAER is all about. It's the theme that runs through every story, every conversation, and every program you hear. Independent news coverage focused on facts, truth, and accountability is an essential public service in Central New York. Become a member today at WAER.org.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. I'm WAER News Director Chris Bolt.
And I'm Katie Zolkowski. Black organizers and activists have long led the fight against racism and discrimination in Syracuse and still do. The NAACP, the former Urban League, Black Lives Matter, and the Dunbar Association, among others, are all working to make our region more equitable.
With us today to talk about that fight for equity and the impact of these organizations, we have Jessica Elliott from the Dunbar Association. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Melanie Littlejohn, formerly of the Urban League. And thank you for joining us, Melanie.
Good, thank you.
So to start, could you both maybe tell us a little bit about both Dunbar Association and the former Urban League, how they formed in Syracuse, what the mission is?
Oh, sure. So the Dunbar Association Incorporated has a very long history in the city of Syracuse. This year, we will be celebrating 103 years in existence. And that kind of aligns itself with the almost the existence of the African-American community here in Syracuse. The Dunbar Association was created as a means to provide resources for African-American people, Black people, as they came to the city of Syracuse, whether that meant helping them find employment, helping them find housing, better access to education, just all of the kind of details and ideas that you would want to have in a flourishing, developing community. So that's where the Dunbar Association has stepped in, and it's really continued its mission here in Syracuse, you know, to eradicate poverty and to create generational wealth within the city of Syracuse, specifically for the African-American community.
Mm-hmm. And Melanie, what about the former Urban League?
Sure. And when I think about the Urban League, has a deep, deep, rich tradition. And the National Urban League, of which the Urban League of Onondaga County was one of probably about – 110 affiliates, if I recall. It may certainly have grown at this point, but the focus of any urban league across the country is about certainly empowering black and brown communities, and it has always been focused on eliminating racial segregation and discrimination, in order to ensure that African Americans get an opportunity to participate on all levels of life. And you know, its mission is just as relevant now as it was in its founding.
Now, could you both maybe speak also to, you mentioned building generational wealth and making life better for the black community in Syracuse. What are some of the specific programs that these organizations have offered that do really make a difference in lives of community members?
So for the Dunbar Association, one of the things that has been a challenge has been COVID. So as a community organization, we have really tried to modify our ways in which we reach the community. Specifically, we have programming for youth, and then we have programming for our seniors. And what we've been kind of tasked to do within COVID is bring the programming to them, since they can't come to us. So just like, you know, other models, the Dunbar Association really focused last year on creating virtual programming for them. And what I mean by that is for our youth specifically, you know, their summer was something that they had been experiencing since March because of the lack of educational exposure that they were receiving. So the Dunbar Association, we kind of created a summer program that encompassed academics, but it also had enrichment activities within it. So what ended up happening is myself, my executive director, and our executive assistant, we kind of put our heads together and we created a historically black college experience for 100 kids in the city of Syracuse.
Oh, wow.
And what that meant was during the morning, they would receive tutoring on their specific grade level that they were in kind of March, but mm-hmm. we pushed them, and we wanted them to really grow, not only in their abilities, but also in their confidence when it came to their academics. For enrichment, we ran the gamut, literally, of things that we offered them. We offered them dance, we offered them step, we offered them, you know, kung fu and gospel choir and all of these different things virtually. To our senior programming, it's the same kind of thing, because unfortunately the elderly community within any population, they don't receive the care and the service that they need. And for our organization, it's very, very vital for us to kind of pay back what we have received from this group of people. So we've created programming that, you know, we provide them with meals. We provide them with access to, you know, information in regards to health and wellness. We provide them with supportive group therapy. All of these things that we do for them virtually. And we've had to do that because of COVID. So prior to, they would come in and they would receive these services, right? Now that we're in the midst of a pandemic, that model has had to shift, it has had to change, it has had to be modified so many times in order to make sure and ensure that the work that we do at the Dunbar Association is continued throughout.
Now, Melanie, the Urban League was really active in the 80s and early 90s. Many might remember Leon Modesty was president for a long time. I remember it was often the voice for equality issues during those times, probably the most prominent voice in the community in many cases. What would you say were some of its biggest impacts back then, if you can remember either particular campaigns or national issues that showed up locally or what have you?
Sure. You know, when I think about some of the work of the Urban League of Onondaga County and under Leon Modesty, who I felt very privileged to work with, you know, when I think about some of those flagship issues, they are still some of the issues that we grapple with today. Police community relations and police community violence, and specifically one of the flagship issues that the League was one of the leading voices in was the Citizens Review Board and
right.
the establishment of that back in the mid-90s when we saw some, you know, exceptional cases around police community interaction, and it had to be addressed and reckoned with as a community. And so the League was in the guiding role in much of that. And from an advocacy position, whether it was advocating back in the 90s around the emergence of HIV/AIDS and how it was ravaging black and brown communities and what was necessary to do in terms of education and outreach, making culturally appropriate education and outreach was also significant. To the focus on economic development and whether it was doing micro-lending to small black and brown businesses in Onondaga County. And then if it certainly at probably the core and root, similar to how we've partnered with organizations for like Dunbar, was around youth development. And what do we need to focus on in on developing strong, focused young people in that they could see and achieve their goals? And what did we need to do from a barrier removal perspective to make that happen for them? So whether it was from policy to jobs to rallying around creating institutional and systemic changes, that was the League then. And certainly when I look at the League now on a national level, it's still the same.
The Dunbar Association is doing great work in the community currently. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how the legacy of black activism and organizing in Syracuse plays into the work that you guys are doing now or advocate for now.
Specifically for myself and for the board and for the leadership of the Dunbar Association, we're steeped in it, right? Mm-hmm. This is, you don't get to this work by being blind. You don't get to this work by being, you know, non-empathetic to the people in which you surround yourself with, the people that you live with. Community activism is something that you see. And when you see it in action, and it has lasting effects on your life, even if you may not realize it at that moment, it is something that furthers the mission. I say that because I'm an educator, and I know what it is to have an impact on young people. So just like Ms. Littlejohn said, you know, this is a lot of work to do, and the work will be there, but we also need to consciously cultivate young people to do the work that is left to do. Yes, we all wish that, you know, everything was how it is supposed to be, you know, a grand utopia. We all wish for those kinds of things, but the reality is it's not. So we have to actively work to reach the goals that we all want to reach so that community can thrive together. And for myself, I know that's how I view community. I don't view community in an individualist kind of light. I view community in a way where I understand that my children will do community with the children that live in their neighborhood and the children that live outside of their neighborhood. So if I want my children to pick people to then make families with, I have to make sure that the entire community is strong and whole in order to make the legacy be one that is great.
And just hearing Jessica Elliott says, wow, right? When I think about the legacy of the League and the voices of advocacy and all of these powerful, unbelievable young leaders that are moving things forward courageously. This is the moment for me that is tremendously impactful, because what I see is the legacy of advocacy has not waned. Matter of fact, it is the new voices and the strong and powerful voices that are emerging and have emerged are doing some unbelievable things, present company included. Jessica, it was phenomenal.
So we've been talking about the Dunbar Center Association and the Urban League with Melanie Littlejohn, formerly of the Urban League, and Jessica from the Dunbar Center. There's also other organizations. You both agreed that the work has always been there. It continues on. You know, there's obviously the NAACP, 100 Black Men of Syracuse, a local national action network group, Black Lives Matter groups that organized a lot in recent years. What's the dynamic between these groups? Issues overlap. Sometimes they're a little more one-focus issues, perhaps, but otherwise very broad. What would you say is the dynamic between some of these groups working together or maybe not working together?
I think solidarity is the mission, right? We all have the same objective. How we get to those objectives differ, because I think that life experiences differ among people. In terms of organizations, I think if you were to go and you were to look at the mission statements for all of the organizations that you've named, there are threads and common themes among them. You know, it gets a little, you know, the table is large because the issues are large. And the reality is you need multiple people, you need multiple organizations to tackle the kind of systemic issues that we are trying to tackle. You know, these issues didn't develop overnight. They are longstanding. You know what I mean? And to that point, the people who sit around that table, we all can see very clearly the writing on the wall. And the writing alludes to that the future is bright. That's the end. The future is very, very bright. And we will eventually get to a space where everything is the way it is supposed to be. And nobody lives in inequity. Nobody lives in an impoverished state. Nobody lives in a space where trauma or violence will be done to their person or to their community. That's the goal. That's what we all want. And we understand that that is a tall order. So we call that, everybody to the table.
That no one group can tackle, obviously.
And we all have to do it together.
Solidarity, period. There's nothing monolithic about this struggle. And there's nothing monolithic about how we're going to approach it. It will take, just as Jessica Elliott just shared, it will take the collective work of us all. But when we know that we are bound together through solidarity, which means equity, parity, which means where we as a Black and brown community come together, there is no difference of opinion when it comes down to solidarity. So I see the collective work of many helping us move there.
Jessica, you mentioned the future, and after this summer of racial justice protests and movements, what was very apparent across the country and in Syracuse was the activism of youth and sort of the next generation of advocates and organizers. How are these organizations that are historically fighting for inequality embracing and encouraging these upcoming generations?
So, one of the young people who is, you know, leading some of those fights, she was one of my students. And this was maybe 7-8 years ago. And I think that the young people of this city have found their voice and they're never going to be silent. That's what we want.
Yep.
My goal as an educator was never to teach them what to think, but teach them how to mm-hmm. think for themselves. I don't want to envision a future for them. I need them to create it. So welcoming them to the table and allowing them to have that type of agency is what pushes us forward. When you try to bring young people into the fold, but you are too stuck in your ways mm-hmm. of what used to be and how things used to be done, you alienate them. For organizations that exist within the city of Syracuse right now, we're not doing that because the young people are not letting it happen. I don't ever want them to let things happen to them. I need them to be the agents of change that they are right now. And for me, I see those young people creating more young people, and it only gets better.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're leading out loud. Leading out loud. Owning this. And that's what we hope for.
You both have mentioned, and it is true, that there's work to be done. It's very clear. Are there things that come to mind that are very present or maybe a little bit glaring when it comes to work that needs to be done in Syracuse? And who needs to be more active to make those things really change, to build those better, more equitable futures?
There's, you know, when we think about this pandemic, right? Both COVID as well as violence and poverty and some of the inequity that's been built by systems, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I think about children and access the digital divide, right? The digital divide, and what that means for the health and vitality of our young people, which equates to the health and vitality of our region and of our state and of our nation, that cannot be underscored enough, and it's all tied around poverty. When I think about what I'm seeing happen around access to education and information and to some of the basic things that help young people be successful, it is pronounced, and the scale is beyond, is not balanced. Mm-hmm. But here's what I will say. This is not the job of the superintendent alone. This is the job of every last business within this region. It is the job of all of our community organizations, our secular and non-secular mm-hmm. organizations. This is about a healing and movement for our entire region because we know what happens when all boats rise, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is probably one of the – that – health equity issues and you know, business-related issues. But when I think about our young people and what we owe them as a region and what we owe them as a community, that is one that keeps me up at night mm-hmm. thinking about the scale that's not balanced.
Melanie, looking back just a little bit, can you say why the Urban League had to close its local chapter? I know bankruptcy was declared at one point, but do you know why it just wasn't able to continue, given that it wasn't for lack of things to do? But was there a reason, or was there ever any sort of looking back to say, you know, here's the impacts it had, but here's why it didn't continue?
So, and that's a great question, Chris, and I think one of the issues or concerns that the league and so many organizations that do hard advocacy work And when you try to seek funding to survive as an organization, and you go to multiple funding sources and which to make that happen, it was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
at some time, because the league did take very hard positions, and certainly in many instances was never ever willing to adjust our position on instances, and at sometimes it made funders a little,
right,
you know, squirrely. But that's okay, because the league's doors may have closed, but the league's mission is still alive.
Gotcha.
I wish it was open, but there is enough good advocacy work going on that the mission will live on.
Maybe just to finish up, let's just get a quick comment from either of you. What are you hopeful about?
I think for me, I've said it maybe umpteen times, that I'm hopeful for the future, right? Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that we can get to a space and place where everybody has exactly what they need and nobody lives in a state of lack. I'm very hopeful for the future in terms of young people walking into what it means to push forward in these ideas of community. I think for me, those are the things that I'm hopeful for.
Yeah. And just to add to Jessica's thoughts, and I subscribe to them all, I'm also hopeful for a place as a mother of two young black men that I want a peaceful night's sleep. Right. I hope for a world and a place where I don't worry about them going out. I don't worry about them traveling. You know, so, yeah, I hope for a world where equity is no longer a discussion point because it's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you both for sharing your time and knowledge with us here today on WAER. We've been talking to Jessica Elliott and Melanie Littlejohn. You're listening to Syracuse Speaks. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Joy Rafferty, owner of Californian Closets of Syracuse. We've been a supporter of WAER for many years now. When it comes to advertising my small business, there are a lot of options out there. I feel that WAER's audience is the perfect fit for us. They're intelligent and loyal, exactly the kind of people we look to reach. And when people call us, they make a point to tell us they heard about Californian Closets on WAER.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks for Black History Month. I'm Chris Bolt. Many people can think back on a vibrant music scene for black musicians and audiences. Musicians such as Isaac Wynn, Marcia Hagen, and Reggie Sigler remember that vitality, but they also remember many doors that remained closed to them performing.
Yeah, I'm Reggie Sigler, and I played with a band for about 35 years. We called it Soft Spoken, and we started back in 1984. But back in 2019, we decided to, 35 years was a long enough run. So that's what I do musically.
All right, great. Thanks, Reggie. Marcia?
Oh, let's see. I don't ever remember ever not singing. I was also a teenager in bands. Most of the early bands that I sang with is now the band called Stroke. I did a lot of church music, worked with the symphony orchestra and with Syracuse Opera, just a bunch of things at that time.
And Isaac?
Hi, my name's Isaac Wynn, and I'm with a group right now called UAD. We're a show group. We choreograph and dress and do all the 70s stuff, you know. I also was in Soft Spoken, as Reggie said. I even sung with Marsha for a while.
Yeah.
And Reggie played with Marsha bass. So.
Oh, yeah, that was a Salt City experience.
Yeah.
So, oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, I've asked each of you to kind of remember back a little bit about musicians. Let's start there with some of the either individual musicians or groups that are significant to you.
Maybe I'll start. I have always been a fan of music history. And like Marsha, I started when I was really young, about 12 years old. And I think I was in my first band at 13. But I remember just watching a lot of the older guys and Lil Willie Gatewood and the Fabulous. Well, they said Tornadoes. And I think it meant tornadoes, but, you know. And in later years, you know, I started taking a liking to Marcus Curry. And in his history, Marcus Curry right now is about 85 years old. Still can play the guitar.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Well, there were just so many at the time. Bobby Hamilton, along with Ronnie Lee, Israel Hagen, Sylvester Hagen. Just different folks in Syracuse doing a lot of blues and R&B.
On Easy Street, I'd like to live on Easy Street, 'cause nobody works on Easy Street, they just sit around all day.
Where were the places that people played that, you know, were venues? What are some of the places that you remember that were significant?
I remember they had the bandwagon that they used to call the Happening Wagon. I think I remember seeing the New Decade on there, and Lil Willie Gatewood, his band was on there. As I got a little older and still quite not old enough to get into the clubs, I used to peep into the window of Pride's place over on South Ave because they had bands over there. By the time I got around 14 years old, maybe 15, I started playing in the clubs because you only had to be 18. And if you were chaperoned and you were playing, you know, a Sunday afternoon matinee, you could come over and play. So I remember the English Inn, I remember Deb's over near Erie Boulevard, and that was with a group called Sound Express.
We were allowed to play in the 800 Club, Shangri-La, Sue Lynn, as long as we brought one parent.
We didn't really play in clubs that much, the UAD thing. We would rent out a place and just throw a big function. Like, we always rent out the Palace Theater, or we'll rent, you know, just a regular venue somewhere. And, you know, we get hired for different events.
Some of the other places that I mentioned to you, not all, but some of them were black-owned places, and they reached out to get black musicians to play those clubs, right? It's a whole 15th Ward type vibe. It was black-owned businesses, black clubs, black people participated and supported them. So many of those names were a part of that. Not all, as I said, but...
Oh, yeah, because there had to be at least 15
mm-hmm.
black clubs.
Yeah.
So that you were guaranteed, and the only other one that would take us out of our... immediate area was Three Rivers Inn.
Oh, right.
They were really, really good about diversifying their entertainment, and they treated us well.
And that's
there was no other place outside of the city of Syracuse that black bands could go play.
I also heard that they were a part of a circuit for, like, Sammy Davis Jr. and, you know, the big-name stars, Frank
yes.
Sinatra, et cetera, et cetera.
There were always famous folks coming through there.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we were always excited if we were opening for somebody. Put it this way, we didn't feel like we were out of place.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if we had tried any other venue outside of Syracuse, I don't think we would have got that kind of welcome.
You know, the popularity of black music, or as we'll call it, you know what I mean?
Right.
Music made by black artists, is sometimes emulated and imitated. When that crosses over, at the point when that crosses over, people start to reach out to want to hear it, you know, in a more authentic, if you will, fashion. So, you know, some of the bands start to integrate, and you get, you know, a couple black guys maybe singing, playing behind or in front of, you know, an all-white band, and they're doing all black music.
Yeah.
As long as
I remember, it about the beginning of the middle 70s, late 70s, it started to change. the actual club owners would tell you. If you had an all-black band, you were not going to get hired. You had to integrate the band. And in their minds, white people would not come to the club if they're all black band members.
Right.
But I do remember playing at, what's the name of that club on Hawley Ave?
English Inn?
English Inn.
English Inn, yeah.
English Inn. We had a whole white band, yeah, and you was the only bass player, right. Black bass player. But the front line was all black. That whole night, man, it was just, you can feel the tension. They hired us, but the audience didn't really want us there. You can feel it.
They call it Stormy Monday. But Tuesday's just as bad.
Isaac Wynn, Marcia Hagen, and Reggie Sigler all have good memories of music played, camaraderie, and culture shared, while each also remembers barriers and boundaries that are part of Syracuse's black music history. I also talked with Frank Malfitano, whom many know as founder and producer of Syracuse Jazz Fest for more than 35 years. But he also has an almost encyclopedic mind about the music black musicians were playing through the years here in Syracuse.
I remember being in high school from 1958 to 1962. We heard about black music because we had friends that were going to Central and other schools that had a larger African-American student population. So we gravitated to neighborhood street corners to see doo-wop. There were groups like the Five Points and the Elderos and the Rhythm Cadets and the Quintones. I mean, these were all great groups. And the Rhythm Cadets recorded a song that was written by George Singleton, Bebo Singleton, called Dearest Doris, that got some airtime. And another group, the Elderos, which Bobby Green was a member of, recorded Please Surrender on the Vesta Records labels. And some of these groups went on to perform on the Arthur Godfrey Show and at the Apollo. And, you know, there was a doo-wop community in the 50s and in the 60s. There were some clubs back then, Debs, I recall Debs on Erie Boulevard, and the Clover Club on Almond Street, where you could go see live performances, and those were very special.
So fast forward just one step, where there might have been a little more of a club scene in the 60s, probably a lot of places that might have flourished then and now are kind of long gone.
The 60s and into the 70s, that was an amazingly fertile period. I can remember in the 15th Ward, the Club 800 and the Embassy and the Penguin and the Jazz Corner, where University College and Reed and Peck Hall are. There was Sid's Hightower Lounge. There was Phoebe's Harkey Lounge, which is now the site of Phoebe's restaurant. Over on the near west side, we had clubs like the Satellite Club and the Dewdrop Inn. And they were as colorful as the names would indicate. They were all about the music and dancing and socializing. And some of the groups I remember from that period were like Larry Ellis and the Black Hammer. Bobby Green had a band called Blue Greens and Beans, the great guitarist. And then, of course, there was the vocalist and showman extraordinaire, the great Art Legs Robin and the Soul Brothers. There was a lot of black music happening in the 60s and a lot of black clubs, and sadly, none of them are around anymore.
Play that thing, man.
University and college campuses were a hotbed for black music in the 60s. I mean, there was social consciousness, there was awareness, social awareness that was on the rise. We were fighting things like racism. So I think university union concert boards played a very important role back then in bringing black music to college campuses, music we would have never seen and heard. I saw some of the greatest blues and jazz artists of all time on the blues side, Mississippi Fred McDowell, Lightnin' Hopkins, the Reverend Gary Davis, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, Taj Mahal. On the jazz side, I saw Charlie Mingus and Sonny Fortune and Sonny Stitt, Wynton and Bradford Marsalis when they left Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers and were out on their own. The black artists that we were privileged to see
all of that happened at Jabberwocky. And yes, it was a mixed audience, and everybody got along. There was never an incident. There was never any friction. It was really great to be able to meet other people in the community, and that was a great way to do it.
All right, then. Hey!
Yes, Jazz Fest was able to create a platform and a forum where we could bring in artists who might not otherwise appear in the marketplace. We delved into R&B and soul and blues and rhythm and blues, and we wanted to make sure that everybody knew that a lot of these branches came from the same roots. We were able to present people like James Cotton, the great harmonica player with Muddy Waters' bands, Coco Taylor, one of the queens of the blues, people like Les McCann and Little Jimmy Scott, perhaps artists that aren't household names. We were also able to present people like B.B. King and Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles. And when we would get these legendary superstars to come in, then we could also present the Hubert Laws and the Ronnie Laws of the world. Jazz Fest was a great vehicle for being able to introduce people to their African-American heritage, and that comprises the bulk of American cultural history. So our music comes from black music, by and large, whether it's pop, soul, rock, whatever it happens to be, it has its roots in black music. So we tried to introduce people to their own music so they could develop an appreciation for where the music came from and the people who made it.
Cigarette holder, that wigs me. Shoulder, she digs me. I'm kidding, yes, that's setting down.
Frank Malfitano, as fan, then promoter, has never been far from Syracuse's black music history, helping to pave the path for some of it along the way. Ronnie Lee shared some of his memories with me as well. He also had more than a front row seat as he became a part of that same history.
The places that I can think of were places like the 800 Club, Debs. There weren't places where black musicians could take a group of black musicians into and work in the mainstream, so to speak. You know, there were a lot of other places like the Little Brown Jug, Lorenzo's, and the Dinkler Motor Lodge, which was wonderful. People were just in there mixing and enjoying the music for what it was. It wasn't a matter of who was on the stages, what they were sending off of the stage. That was the whole point. So it was very, very good. At least it was for me. If you wanted to have a group of black musicians, it didn't happen unless you were in a black-owned establishment. And that's not to say that blacks weren't working in the other places. They were. But it had to be like maybe if you had a quartet, for instance, you had one black person there. That was it, you know. I can recall even working at a place around town that I worked at frequently. And I think there was one white guy in the group out of a sextet. And the owner, who I got along with famously, said, well, who's in the group? And I told him, he says, Ronnie, I can't do that. I says, what do you mean you can't do it? He says, you got all black guys in the group. He says, I can't do it.
This little song from my father does things that no other can do.
Now, one of the things about some of the establishments, we'll talk about musicians in just a minute. Some of those establishments were associated with like the 15th Ward that got urban renewaled
right
out of existence. What do you feel like is lost because those kinds of places have largely gone away? Not entirely, but largely.
Well, I think we've kind of lost the growth of our culture here. We lost being able to listen to some of the origination of the music. We have lost what jazz really is. We didn't open up to allow the people who could play the music with a little more authenticity to perform.
So who are some of the musicians you can remember that were, you know, significant in the area?
The people that I recall early on here in Syracuse, Bobby Scott, Little Willie Gatewood, Don Smith, Walt Maddox, Marcus Curry, who is here now, and Marcus and I worked together for quite some time. You know, Charlie Sparks was a singer that comes to mind for me. Mm-hmm. Charlie Sparks, in my estimation, was this wonderful, wonderful baritone. He always looked so neat and presentable. Tuxedo, mohair. I call Charlie Syracuse's answer to Nat King Cole. And that's what he was. He was smooth like that. Oh, man, he was. Perform. As a matter of fact, there was a fellow named Bill Bristow, a drummer, who hired me. I was in this place called the Thor Lounge. Bill Bristow, John Taylor played guitar. Billy Smith was playing saxophone. He used to hop on the bar and walk the bar while he was playing his sax, you know. You guys ever allow anybody to sing with you? And he said, you want to sit in? He said, sure, man. I says, you guys know Girl from Ipanema? He says, sure, what key? I didn't know what key. I said, well, whatever's on the jukebox, you know. So they played it and I sang it and people applauded. And he said, hey, man, you want to sing another song? I sat down. People were thanking me at the bar. They came, oh, congratulations, you sound great. When they took a break, he came over and he says, man, you want a job? He says, he hired me. So that was my first foray into singing jazz music out.
I mean, so that sounds like it actually was welcoming, supportive.
It was.
With limits?
With Bill and those guys, I didn't feel any limits. I just felt like I was being released. Some of the other musicians around town, some of the white musicians would come in and they listened, and a couple of those guys started to hire me. All of a sudden, I found myself doing a wedding with Nate Levine somewhere at the state fairgrounds. This rock player came in, a guitar player, and he says, man, you shouldn't be doing this. You should be out singing the blues with me and my band. You know? And I found myself working in some of the mainstream clubs, you know. 30 or so years later, I said, man, you know, you couldn't work there. And if you found that you couldn't work in a place, for me, I would just go, okay, well, what's next? I got to go find something else, you know. I wasn't overly concerned with it. I was concerned, but not overly concerned with it, you know.
Some of the memories of the black music scene here in Syracuse by Ronnie Lee, Frank Malfitano, and before them, we heard from Isaac Wynn, Marcia Hagen, and Reggie Sigler. Syracuse Speaks is a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media, with support from the St. Mary Ann Cope Shrine and Museum's Empathy in Action Initiative. Additional support also comes through a generous grant from National Grid and listeners like you. Our executive producer is Joe Lee, and today's show was produced by Kevin Kloss. You can listen to today's show or past Syracuse Speaks episodes at waer.org. For Katie Zilkowski, I'm Chris Bolt. Thanks for listening. This is WAER Syracuse.